The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, my friends, welcome back to Capital Thinking. I'm tan, rested, and ready after a couple weeks of vacation. Hope you're enjoying the last full month of summer. We've got a full show for you today. We're going to talk a lot about health care reform and some of the other hot political issues in what should be a cool month in Washington, with Congress and the White House largely out of action. Instead, has turned into an incendiary month with town halls across the country firing up citizens to exercise their democratic rights and talk to elected officials about health care reform. But before we get into that, we're going to talk about a groundbreaking domestic relations matter here in the state of Virginia. Our guest this segment is Ben Chu, one of the nation's capital's more distinguished litigators with the law firm of Patton Boggs. Ben, I think this is your first time on the show, so welcome to your maiden voyage here on Capital Thinking.
Thank you very much, Kevin. I appreciate the opportunity to be on your show.
Well, listen, Ben, tell us a little bit about Burgos versus Flaherty and what's happening there and why it matters so much.
Well, I'll give you a little background, Kevin, and it's a pro bono case we handled on behalf of our client, Jane Burgos, who has a 12-year-old daughter and through various circumstances lost track of the paternal father and was able to get in contact with him, find out where he was. Just within the last several months, he lives in Paris. And so the issue, of course, our immediate issue was to get him to own up to his responsibilities as a parent. And we brought an action in the Commonwealth of Virginia, where our client lives and where her daughter lives. And we brought that case in the Juvenile and Domestic Relations Court.
Oh, very good. And tell us a little bit about what happened and what the legal issues involved in this case were.
The threshold legal issue, Kevin, was one of jurisdiction. And in the Juvenile Domestic Relations Court, the defendant successfully argued that the court had no jurisdiction over him because the child was conceived in France and their client, the father, lived in France. So there was not sufficient nexus or connection to Virginia to bestow jurisdiction in that court. We appealed the decision to the circuit court, and the circuit court rendered a different decision. We had made an argument under the Virginia long-arm statute, which deals with issues of personal jurisdiction, and argued that the court should not literally just look at the place of conception, but look at the statutory definition of fathered. And we argued successfully that fathered is more than just the act of conception, and we were able to point the court, Judge Ney, to the fact that the defendant, the father, had at one time visited the child in the Commonwealth of Virginia and had acknowledged the child as his own. So the court, in a case of first impression, that is a matter that had never been interpreted by any court in the Commonwealth of Virginia, Judge Ney found that that constituted fathering under the statute, so that, in fact, we did have personal jurisdiction. The court had personal jurisdiction over the father.
I'm breaking out into a cold sweat, Ben, because, you know, law schools are starting up around the country this week, and some 1Ls in a class talking about personal jurisdiction and long-arm statutes, and that's a term that unless you're in the litigation field, you probably haven't spent a lot of time thinking about since you took civil procedure. And it's interesting. Tell me, this seems like a very novel approach that you took. Were there a lot of precedents you found outside the state of Virginia for the arguments that you made here on jurisdictional grounds, or were you basically creating a novel approach in and of itself?
Kevin, that's an excellent question. On the general jurisdictional issue, Virginia is a one-act jurisdiction, which means that as long as you have one act that's relevant and tied to the Commonwealth, then you have sufficient jurisdiction. But in answer to your question, because no court in Virginia had defined the term fathered, we did look to other jurisdictions. We looked to all 50 states, and in fact, it was a novel issue because no other state had a statute drafted the way Virginia's statute was. So it was sui generis. So we had nothing to which we could point the court other than what we argued was the logic of our position, that fathered had to mean something independent of mere conception. And we do think that this will have ramifications in Virginia for other mothers who were seeking support and paternal responsibility whose children were not conceived in the Commonwealth. And we believe it probably will have application outside the Commonwealth for statutes which don't have exactly the same language but have similar language.
Very interesting, because, you know, my impression of Virginia courts in particular is they're not the state courts that push the envelope on a lot of things. But you mentioned that there are broader implications for Virginians. I guess, can you give us some examples of how you see the decision here by Judge Ney, how that will play out for other cases in the future?
Well, I think it will play out for other cases, especially if it's a published decision. Not all decisions of the circuit court are published. But if this is one that is published, I think obviously the ramifications will be broader. To the extent the defendant appeals it, most appeals go directly to the Supreme Court of Virginia, except those matters that deal with domestic relations and criminal matters, which go to the Court of Appeals. So to the extent that this is raised to the issue of the Court of Appeals, then I think it could have extremely wide ramifications because it would be the only widely reported case that deals with this issue. And I think more broadly, I think, Kevin, your observation is apt, that the Commonwealth of Virginia tends to be a fairly conservative jurisdiction generally, highly reliant on precedent, and not generally inclined to make new law or rule from the bench, or make law from the bench, which is not what happened here. This was a question that came out of the statute, so it was clearly within the purview of the judge, so it was appropriate for him to make the decision that he did without going too far out of the box. And I think it was clearly colored by the public policy of wanting to make sure to provide for the best interest of the child. And that's a principle which, as you know, Kevin, applies in all matters relating to domestic relations, whether it's paternity, whether it's custody, whether it's support. The court is always guided inherently by the best interest of the child as opposed to the parents. So I think clearly that was something that was in the background here, and something which had to inform the court, the way the court viewed this issue.
Ms. Berghaust, you sort of circled around it, but I just want to make sure we're clear. What are the next steps in the case? It sounds like, you know, you may have an appeal headed to the Virginia Supreme Court, and if so, how do you anticipate the arguments might shift there, since you'll now be defending the new rationale that has been accepted at the circuit court? And if it's not appealed, how will your client, what sort of relief is she anticipating if it's not appealed?
If it's not appealed, and we're obviously, that would be our preferred approach, would just be to get the defendant to own up to his responsibilities. There's no real question that he, in fact, is the father. And we would hope that at this point, now that he's lost the jurisdictional battle, he will do the right thing by his child and pay up the back support that he's owed, because our client has had to bear the entire burden herself, which is a terribly unfair thing and not good for the child. So we're hoping for a happy ending and some kind of involvement of the father in his daughter's life. So it could be a happy ending for all concerned, and that's what we would like. To the extent that it does go to appeal, we will see whether there's anything else other than what we've already argued and other than what the court has already cited in support of its decision. But we're confident that it would be upheld on appeal. It's the right decision under the law, and it's the right decision on the equities.
Very good. And then I guess just, again, thinking about the future implications, you know, are there cases where this new definition of fatherhood outside of just the act of conception might lead some domestic matters to be essentially forum shops so that they end up in Virginia and you can apply this new and different standard to child cases, or do you not see that that is likely?
It's another good question. I think it's probably less likely in terms of forum shopping, but I do think it opens up additional forums, potential forums for jurisdiction. In other words, if other states adopted this approach, then there would be several alternative venues for bringing an action. In other words, if a father, for example, had visited a child in North Carolina or had done it in other states, those two would have jurisdiction.
Yeah, very interesting. I was just thinking, you know, more about the father who brings the kids to D.C. to see the sites and ends up staying in Northern Virginia. Is that the one act that suddenly opens up the Virginia court system to somebody in these cases?
Under this decision, it would.
Very interesting. Well, that certainly is an eye-opener. Well, we have been joined. Ben, before we let you go, I want to get your email address out there in case people want to contact you. And I don't know if there's anyone else on your legal team that was involved in this case that you want to just give a shout-out to for their role in helping secure this victory.
Absolutely. Zach Mendelson and Chris Wagner were instrumental in briefing and argument. They were the heroes of this case. No question about it. My email address is bchew@patentbox.com.
Great. Well, Ben, thanks. We'll have you back on. I know Ben Chew's one of the more innovative and distinguished litigators here in the Washington, D.C. area. We've been talking about his success in a domestic relations case here in the state of Virginia that has expanded the definition of fatherhood. And we're going to be back in just a moment to talk about health care reform. So keep it here on Capital Thinking.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
It's all about action.
Touchdown!
Scores.
Taking a look at the NBA tonight.
Highlights.
He's broken loose. He's at the 30.
And headlines.
Big trade in the NFL this afternoon.
When you are looking to talk sports, look no further than the Voice America Sports Network. We bring you some of the biggest names and all the sports news you can handle, whether it's basketball.
Off the glass.
Football.
Come on.
Golf. Racing. Or the Olympics. We've got you covered. We'll even cover tailgating. To the Voice America Sports Network. It's all things sports.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back to the show. Well, unless you've been hiding in a cave for the last month, you can find command performances on television of angry citizens exercising their democratic rights to talk to their elected officials about what's going on with health care reform. So we wanted to spend some time updating you on what is going on with the health care reform debate in a dispassionate and factual way, and we're joined by one of my colleagues from Patton Boggs, one of the leaders of the healthcare policy group there, Marty Kendrick, who's frequently appeared on the show, and she's interrupting her vacation time in upstate New York to check in with us. Marty, how are you today?
I'm fine, Kevin.
Good. Well, listen, let's start from the beginning. These guys went out at the end of July in the House instance and the first week of August in the Senate instance to talk a little bit about when they left, they were making some progress on health care reform, and that progress, I think, has sort of gotten lost. So let's start with where were they when they left town, and let's look first at the Senate. What was the status of the Senate's bill when they left town?
In the Senate, both the Health, Education, Labor, and Pension Committee, the HELP Committee as it's called, and the Senate Finance Committee were working and have been working for several months to produce their individual bills. The concept is that the bills would be merged for final floor consideration. The Senate Help Committee, who you may recall was under the temporary leadership of Senator Chris Dodd of Connecticut, with Senator Kennedy's absence and illness, had held a multi-week-long markup session, and the committee approved and reported out the Affordable Health Choices Act on July 15th with the vote very split among down party lines. The more conservative and actually, you know, far more bipartisan Senate Finance Committee is still working to produce a Senate bill that could muster sufficient moderate support in order to secure the necessary 60 votes, which would overcome any anticipated filibuster in the Senate.
And we've seen, Marty, a lot sort of bandying about a September 15th timeline for the Finance Committee to have something come out. Is that right?
That is the goal, and the so-called Gang of Six has been working through the August recess to try to achieve and produce a bipartisan bill by that time frame.
Well, let's move over to the House side. They left a week earlier to start their summer recess. What was the status of legislation on the House side when they got out?
Well, in the House, two of the three committees with jurisdiction over health care issues, the Ways and Means Committee and the Education and Labor Committee, both undertook and completed markups with overnight sessions about 3 weeks ago now. Both those committees voted along, again, largely party lines to approve H.R. 3200, America's Affordable Health Care Choices Act. Three conservative Democrats voted against the bill in the Ways and Means Committee, which I think is a telling sign. On the House side, in the Energy and Commerce Committee, after multiple postponements because of the efforts to resolve opposition of the fiscally conservative Blue Dog Democrat coalition, that the House Energy and Commerce Committee markup did finish on July 31st, just as Congress was leaving town, narrowly passing a bill, 31-28, with five Democrats joining Republicans in opposition. Again, I would underscore that the three House versions, which are called the tri-committee bill, must be reconciled and considered on the House floor. They're working through the month of August at the staff level to try to merge differences. The interesting thing, or dynamic, if you will, is that nearly 60 liberal Democrats wrote a letter to the Speaker just before the recess threatening to vote against a final bill if it incorporates some of the Blue Dog Democrat negotiated changes, while on the flip side, 52 members of the Blue Dog Coalition have indicated formally in writing that they would oppose a bill that does not include their changes. Therefore, I think when Congress comes back and the folks trying to do the reconciling, they're creating, they've got a fundamental challenge to passing the bill that is not going to garner any significant Republican support. So it's a precarious and situation even, you know, going into the August recess. But I think most observers believe that Speaker Pelosi will be able to marshal the votes and drive a Democratic bill through the House.
Well, Marty, as I said, you'd practically have to be living in a cave the last few weeks to have not seen on TV or the radio or read in the newspaper or, you know, gone on YouTube and seen how passionate and emotional Americans are in confronting their congressionally elected officials and talking about the future of health care reform. We've had these town hall meetings across the country where citizens have been talking about a variety of things, everything from claims of death panels, whether or not illegal immigrants are covered, how the health care reform will be paid for in respect to the deficit. A lot of this information, given the Internet's abilities, a lot of the information that is bandied about ultimately tends to be factually disproved. But what does the reaction at the town halls and the outpouring of people interested in this issue really say about how health care reform legislation will be handled going forward in Congress?
Well, to much surprise, I think, on the part of particularly many Democrats, what we've seen expressed by the American people over the August district work period, I think that passage of a final health care reform bill by Congress appears, you know, fairly unattainable before the fall, if not, you know, within the calendar year. I think the most optimistic among us believe that negotiations in the Senate, provided they continue on a bipartisan basis, even though, you know, there have been signals in recent days that these are potentially faltering, that that you could get, if you keep the fiscally conservative Blue Dog Democrat coalition objections moving forward, that, you know, you could get legislation. However, I think observers would tell you today in Washington that it's unlikely that either chamber will really be able to hold floor votes on the individual versions of the legislation until late September at the earliest. I think there's going to need to be a buffer between members returning from Congress in early September and actually getting it worked out. The most realistic view probably is that the legislative timetable slips even further.
Yeah, it seems like one of the problems that the folks in Congress are going to have is that they're going to face a great deal of criticism between the point when a final bill emerges in the House from those tri-committees or gets to the Senate floor and when a vote is taken, with all the people who are attacking elected officials for not taking the time to actually read the details of the bills that are pending already.
Exactly. They're going to need to really digest and respond to much of the concern that is being registered out there. And I think to barrel ahead, given the anger, given the distrust, given the contentious town meetings that have been occurring and in many parts of the country, without taking into account voters' viewpoints, would be a mighty risky proposition. Particularly for vulnerable and first-term Democrats.
Yeah, I think I wouldn't even say first-termers. I'd say anybody, especially on the House side, elected in the last 6 years when Republicans faltered and Democrats surged, is probably looking very closely at what this vote means for their political futures, and they're weighing that calculus heavily. Well, let's switch. Let's go down the Pennsylvania Avenue from the Capitol to the White House and President Obama, who has certainly not had the August he would have hoped to have even a month ago. Do you think the president's going to get a deal done here?
I think that President Obama still can get a deal, but I do think that President and the Congress may have to go back to the drawing board in light of these new challenges. Folks are seeing primarily two courses of political action in recent days. There's been discussions that, the Democrats just push forward with a Democratic-only bill and force it through Congress, or alternatively that, everybody steps back, reevaluates the situation and the legislation and try to be less ambitious in achieving bipartisan legislation. Interestingly, this morning, the White House word was that the administration is considering splitting the health care reform bill into two pieces. The first part would address issues that could garner bipartisan support. For example, the new regulations in the bill that would prohibit insurers from denying coverage based on pre-existing medical conditions, and provisions that would place caps on some out-of-pocket expenses, and push that legislation through so that there's a vote and it achieves more than 60 votes. It's a bipartisan vote. The Republicans would find it very difficult to vote against those provisions. But then move forward with a second part bill that would couple and address the more contentious issues such as the public plan option, and try to move that piece of legislation through the budget reconciliation process, because only a majority vote would be required. But
Marty, let me
approach opens some major political challenges for members, I think.
Marty, let me stop you there. We're going to take a break for commercial, and we'll be right back to talk more about health care.
Whether the market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hola.
Konnichiwa.
Bonjour.
Hello.
From Anchorage to Abu Dhabi.
Merhaba.
From Denver to Doha.
Ciao.
Patton Boggs makes business transactions the world over.
Oi.
Rely on our insights for your next deal. Patton Boggs, the international business team. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The
business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right. Hey, Kevin O'Neill with you. I'm joined by Marty Kendrick, a healthcare policy partner at the law firm of Patton Boggs in Washington, D.C. We're talking about the current status of healthcare reform. Just before the break, Marty was talking about the two options that the White House and the Congress face right now, and that's whether or not to split the healthcare reform bill into two pieces, one that would address bipartisan support, and then a second, more controversial piece that would consider things like the public plan, or whether or not to jam something through on a straight Democratic vote, since they have majorities in both chambers of Congress. Marty, you mentioned that the second part, the public plan option, could move under reconciliation. Just talking a little bit about that, isn't it? Isn't one of the problems with moving a second piece under the reconciliation process, which requires a lower threshold in the Senate in particular, isn't one of the problems that you have to show that what you have actually saves money and contributes to deficit reduction long term? And can a public plan actually be proven to do that?
Well, the arguments go both ways, and the scoring by CBO obviously will be pivotal. Reconciliation process legislatively, opens additional challenges like Byrd Rule and other kinds of procedural requirements. So, quite honestly, I think that they've not really thought through completely whether the primary goals really could be achieved if they use the budget reconciliation process, and it is a process that will force Democrats more to walk the plank. One of the big challenges that the administration and the Senate Democratic leadership still face is that they do not have sufficient number of Senate Democrats who are on board as endorsing the public plan option. Many middle of the road to conservative Democrats in the Senate have expressed major reservations about the public plan, while more liberal Democrats are very determined to that any kind of legislation it should have a litmus test of the public plan option. So if I had to predict at this point, I think going back to the primary question you asked before the break, Kevin, do you think President Obama can get a deal? I think the answer is yes, but certainly there will be a need to drop back and potentially compromise. And I think that some of the messages coming out of the White House are signaling that, although somewhat confusing. And certainly, there's some loud and clear messages coming out of the town hall meetings.
Yeah, what about the town hall meetings? I mean, if you were a senator or a representative, what would these meetings be telling you? What kind of feedback do you draw from them?
Well, most recently, there's a new Rasmussen Reports National Telephone Survey that just was released that indicates opposition to the president's plan has increased to 53%, with now only 42% of United States voters still favoring the plan. Yet it's interesting that despite the diminishing support, 51% of all voters still say that it's somewhat likely that a health proposal will become law this year. I think what we have to recognize is that the House Democrats produced a very ambitious, robust health care proposal. And if anything, that the town meetings are showing a huge amount of angst and also distrust of Congress and some of our major institutions. Come September, a new message may be that we have to move more slowly. I personally think it's a political mistake, especially for the vulnerable Democrats, to push forward with a totally partisan Democrats-only approach, because in particular, you know, number of the provisions in the bill do not really take effect until 2013 or even later. So, you know, there's lots of risk. The bill is fraught with risk for unraveling between now and the effective date of when health care reform really kicks in.
So you don't think there's much chance that Democrats will? We've seen a lot of back and forth, good cop, bad cop, both out of the Democrats and the White House and in Congress, and the Republicans sort of lobbing bobs into the process, alleging that Democrats will ultimately choose not to go down the bipartisan road but will go it alone.
Well, I think the Republican base and you know, some Republican leaders are maintaining that the Democrats are now focused on a go-it-alone, Democrat-only approach. I mean, there's a major article this past week in the Wall Street Journal. But, you know, I think there is a very sincere behind-the-scenes Democratic strategy discussion going on about, you know, does the strategy shift and is it, you know, is it just important to pass a health care reform without Republican support through the reconciliation process? But, you know, again, I perceive at least that the Republicans and the administration and many Democrats in Congress are holding out the hope that there can be a bipartisan product. The administration and the Senate Finance Committee in particular are eager to accomplish that. I do think that there are some cautionary notes that we've heard this week. In particular, Senator Grassley, who is ranking Republican member of the Senate Finance Committee, pointed to his experience in the town meetings in Iowa and you know, his perception that support for a bipartisan bill is faltering. He's you know, now signaling, and folks are jumping on him, that health reform is becoming more chancy, and he's you know, the Gang of Six, the people, the leaders on the Senate Finance Committee who are working together in a bipartisan way are still meeting a couple of times before Congress reconvenes in September. They're actually doing a telephone conference call this evening. But, you know, Senator Grassley, Senator Enzi, you know, others and other Republicans in the Senate, I mean, they're not going to vote for a bill that doesn't have fairly significant Republican support. So although Senator Grassley has said he hasn't given up hope, he certainly has said that the raucous town hall meetings are causing, in his view, bipartisan agreement probably to become more difficult. A compromise potentially could become harder.
Yeah, very interesting. The very thing that people are calling for in the meeting to be listened to could be poisoning the well. Those meetings could be poisoning the well for bipartisanship back in Washington. Well, let's talk a little bit about this very controversial public option and sort of its alternative, the co-ops. The co-ops seem to be sort of bubbling to the top, but they continue to be criticized as well. Can you shed some light on the distinctions between the two options here?
Sure. There's been some confusion and confusing signs that have emanated from the White House, from the President, and from Secretary Sebelius on whether a public plan option is necessary from the administration perspective. And at the same time, Senator Ken Conrad, who has been the primary leader pushing a cooperative plan option, there's been more discussion, and that's come more to the forefront. And I think the perception until at least this week is that the Senate Finance Committee is much more likely to include a nonprofit, state-based insurance cooperative approach in the legislation. But neither the liberals nor the Republicans seem very enthused about the idea. Robert Pair had a very harsh article in the New York Times earlier this week, for example, that the president has signaled most recently that everything is on the table while trying to reinforce that, you know, the public option is still vital to health care reform and is his choice. I want to just mention one interesting approach. There's another option that may be coming back into the discussion. Senator Olympia Snowe from Maine, a moderate Republican from Maine, who is a member of the Senate Finance Committee and has been one of the Gang of Six negotiators, has suggested the possibility of a public plan trigger that under which no public plan would actually be offered unless certain goals were achieved by the private insurance companies and the cooperative plans that would be offering their products through the insurance exchanges, that the public plan would go into effect if specific goals were not met. Now, this is very similar to an approach that was enacted in the Medicare Modernization Act of 2003 when Congress passed the prescription drug benefit under Medicare. And interestingly, there's been no need to actually create a government plan due to the numerous private sector plans that are offered in each state. So although the Medicare Modernization Act contained a trigger mechanism, the trigger has never been pulled. So I think folks are now looking at that approach again and starting to think about that.
Interesting. Well, I got time for one more question before our next break,
yep.
Marty.
Yep.
What do you see President Obama doing to regain control of this debate that he's lost control of this month?
Well, I think the president and the administration, I mean, is certainly trying very hard and aggressively to attempt to regain control of the debate. There's town meetings, there's editorials and interviews, he's traveling, he's on the road today. I think that the president is rightly trying to refocus reform message and keep the momentum going. You know, the status quo is just not acceptable, and I think that the president is trying to push hard in holding insurance companies accountable and reining in costs. So most interesting is that the president actually is setting out to appeal to new groups. There was a conference call from the White House to the religious community, multi-denominational pastors, rabbis, and leaders, where the president last night called on getting health care reform done as a core ethical and moral obligation to ensure all Americans and lower health care costs. So, you know, I think the president is trying hard now.
Interesting. Well, we've been joined by Marty Kendrick, a partner in the healthcare policy group at Patton Boggs. If you're interested in speaking with Marty about this, her email address is mkendrick at pattonboggs.com. That's mkendrick at pattonboggs.com. We'll be back in just a moment with more on Capital Thinking.
The market's up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network. From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, my friends, welcome back to the show. I've really appreciated having Marty Kendrick on talking about healthcare reform. And now we've got just a little bit of time left to talk about some of the other hot issues of the day. Some things have been percolating during our absence. Had a great 2 weeks off, spent some time down in South Carolina at Hilton Head on the beach and in the pool, and it was obvious that at least there in one of the premier domestic resorts in the United States that the economy continues to suffer. Saw lots of closed restaurants and shops that used to be open and vibrant in years past, and continues to be a sign that less people are traveling. When they are traveling, they're spending less money. That our economy continues to be in very troubled waters. So this week we've seen even more bad news. We've had unexpected bad employment numbers or unemployment numbers rolled out today, showing a significant uptick in the number of people filing for first-time unemployment benefits. Continues to show that more folks are getting laid off and less opportunities exist for new employment out there, and that's a problem. For everyone who says that there are green shoots in the economy, the unemployment figures, which tend to trail a recovery, of course, do show that we haven't perhaps bottomed out yet on the unemployment side. What I think is very interesting is there are a number of articles just in the last few days that point out that this recovery is not jobless so far, but the only place that's adding any jobs are state and local and federal government. That's the kind of thing that it's great people are getting state, federal, and local government jobs, but those aren't the things that drive economic recovery in the future. I think one of the reasons you're seeing a number of proposals from President Obama be attacked, be it health care or cap and trade, is that they largely create significant new government bureaucracies without the promise of stimulating significant new growth in the private sector for the industries that will be regulated by the government. I think that's a real problem. We see this week a fairly significant dip in the stock market's recovery earlier this week, and I think what many economists are worried about is a recovery that is shaped like a W, where we have an uptick, and then for a variety of reasons we have another substantial decline, another trench in our economic development. We may have reached that top of the W in the middle, and may be headed back down again. When you look at some of the key economic indicators, talked about unemployment, but what about a couple of other things? Commercial real estate continues to be in the tank in a lot of places across the country. And all these people who've been laid off in 2009, well, guess what's coming with a lot of them? Foreclosures. We'll see foreclosure rates going up. There are articles this week about credit card default rates increasing this quarter. Why is that? Well, people who lost their jobs last quarter are having trouble paying Visa and MasterCard this quarter. And that's obviously going to continue to sort of snowball here and cause a number of problems. And as foreclosure rates increase, you'll see the banks have more problems. We may finally reach the bottom that we need to reach in the residential real estate market so we can start rebuilding there. But with so many homeowners having lost their equity over the last 18 months, will they be in any position to go out and buy a new house or even tap that whatever equity might remain in their house to make improvements or start spending again? We got to open those wallets, and all indications, we haven't reached the market conditions needed to open those wallets again. Now, I mentioned state and local government. I want to say again, I think, man, we're going to have some real problems here, especially when the stimulus money runs out in about 18 months, and that state and local governments are adding jobs or preserving jobs because of the stimulus money that they're getting now, and that's great, but it's preventing the reality of the situation from being confronted. We see state governments here in Virginia. The state government came back just yesterday to announce further cuts that they have to deal with in a special session of the legislature. I know other states are confronting huge budget gaps as well, and the stimulus money is helping minimize that gap. But if the local governments and the state government aren't forced to make tough decisions now, the question is 18 months from now when the money runs out, are they going to be in any better position to handle those issues, or are we just kicking the can down the road here on the problem? I don't know, but we're gonna find out. I suspect that we aren't making the hard choices at some of these levels of government that we need to make now because the feds are floating us this stimulus money. Well, I want to talk about Libya. Big news today is the release of the so-called Lockerbie bomber. He was convicted in Scotland of bombing of Flight 103. And that took the lives of almost 200 Americans. It's a very controversial case that's now 20 years old, and the man convicted of that killing, Abdel Basset Megrani, was released today by Scottish officials due to the fact he's got terminal prostate cancer. And Scottish law seems to allow this sort of release in some cases. It's very controversial. Now, I'll tell you, let me put my chips on the table. I graduated from Syracuse University, where 35 of my classmates were on this flight, and I can tell you exactly where I was when the Flight 103 went down in 1988, where I was when I found out in a pre-internet, pre-really cable news environment. And I know the devastation it took on friends of mine, colleagues of mine at the university. And it has been an incredible American disappointment that through several different administrations, we have failed. The justice system worldwide has failed, and the American government has time and again allowed the easy road to be taken. There's no doubt that the Libyan leader, Muammar Gaddafi, green-lighted the bombing of Flight 103. No real sanctions have been taken against him. We had sanctions against Libya before then. We had sanctions against them after them. Many of those sanctions have actually been loosened in the last couple years as Libya tries to rejoin the mainstream society of nations. But he's paid no price for the bombing of 103. A lot of people think that this gentleman who was released today was actually nothing more than a pawn and was put up as the guy who did it, when in fact he may not have been the brains of the operation or even the guy who actually did it. And I just think it's very disappointing that the British, the Scots, allowed this man to be free. It's compassionate, I guess, but this guy never took responsibility and apologized to the families of the folks who died in this bombing. So to let him go home so he could die in peace when he was himself a mass murderer, it's a terrible message to send, especially at a time when Americans are under attack in Afghanistan and Iraq for We're facing continued suicide bombings there. What a message to send to Al-Qaeda and others that, hey, don't worry about killing Americans or Western Europeans. We really won't impose that big we're certainly not going to put you to death, and we might even release you after just 8 years of a life sentence. He served a couple months of time for each of the 200 or so folks that he downed. And it's a very disappointing day, very frustrating day, I know, for many of my friends from Syracuse and for many who believe that this sort of terrorism has to be met with, if not military action, at least justice that prevails. Last big story of the day I want to talk about is a letter from Ted Kennedy to the governor of Massachusetts today that I think indicates he's about to step down. He's talking to them about how to appoint a successor so that the state has two senators. I would expect to perhaps have an announcement as soon as Labor Day about perhaps Senator Ted Kennedy stepping down rather than trying to come back to the Senate from his the brain tumor that he's confronting now. Certainly, we wish Senator Kennedy the best in his fight against that, but very interesting politically if a man who served 47 years is getting ready to leave the Senate at this critical time. We'll be back next week with more on Capital Thinking. Until then, Voice of America Network.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.
Thanks again for listening to the preceding program, brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the preceding program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.